For years, John Stossel was an oddity on network television. He was a news correspondent allowed to present a strong point of view, first as ABC's crusading consumer reporter, then as a contrarian defender of corporate interests. Stossel has now left ABC for Fox Business Network. As NPR's David Folkenflik reports, his career path captures many of the changes in the news business.
John Stossel is making the transition from the tightly edited taped world of network news to live cable TV.
Maybe we can have bigger note cards?
No, not if you want them printed like this.
To judge by a rehearsal earlier this week, change can be stressful.
Good first rehearsal, everybody.
Really, it feels recklessly confused and slow and awful.
You probably remember John Stossel. It's hard to forget that mustache and that tone of voice, as in his cheeky introduction to last night's debut of the weekly self-titled Stossel on Fox Business.
The globe is warming. Sea levels are going to rise. Does that mean that all these people are going to drown? I'll be okay. I've got a life jacket and a raft, but are all these other people going to die?
Stossel couldn't be more upfront about having a point of view. In fact, in an interview on the set, Stossel says he moved from bashing businesses to realizing most of society's ills stem from another source.
We want mommy government to take care of us, and any child wants mommy and daddy to step in. And if you're really not economically literate, you think that the specialists in Washington and state capitals can plan our lives better than we can.
And so last night's first hour of Stossel mocked politicians and scientists, the elites who share concerns about climate change. Miles O'Brien covered science, space, and the environment for CNN for 17 years. He says Stossel is honest about where he's coming from and that that's the direction American journalism is headed. But O'Brien also says it's troubling that Stossel is cherry-picking his facts.
I'd be very curious if John Stossel, if we had him on the conference call right now, if he would call himself a journalist in the purest sense. He's an advocate. He is somebody who stimulates discussion. He's a provocateur. But is he a journalist?
Actually, Fox calls Stossel an opinion show host, and he has a different boss than the reporters do. Richard Wald was his boss as senior vice president for editorial quality at ABC News in the 1990s. He says Stossel was a valuable counterpoint to lazy reporting that relied upon liberal assumptions. But Wald added a caution.
Some of the criticism was that what he was doing wasn't based on fact, it was based on opinion. And to that extent, I think that his reports suffered.
He's been a vocal ideological figure off the air, too. In October, for example, Stossel addressed Americans for Prosperity. The group is financed largely by the libertarian billionaire David Koch and fosters opposition to Democratic health care proposals. Stossel was similarly skeptical on ABC earlier this year.
But wait a sec. Health insurance means someone else pays your bill.
Stossel says ABC came to be a bad fit.
Here they have more airtime, and they are open to most everything. At ABC, you would have 100 meetings about what was appropriate, and I had many ideas they did not want to do. So it's the main reason I came to Fox, because I wanted to do those things.
During last night's show on climate change, his like-minded guests were the experts, challenged only by a few college kids in the audience.
Hey, I don't think there's enough libertarian media out there, so this is a libertarian show. I'm going to favor libertarians.
For Stossel, his new life at Fox Business means no apologies for ideology. David Folkenflik, NPR News, New York.
Tom Ford is mainly known as a designer. He revived the Gucci fashion house, then went on to start one of his own. Now Tom Ford is adding to his resume. He's directed his first film. It's called A Single Man. It stars Colin Firth. Our critic Bob Mondello says the movie is, as you might expect, stylish.
George Falconer is in mourning, but scarcely anyone knows it. The year is 1962, and as a college professor in Los Angeles, George can't let on what he's feeling, or for that matter, who he is.
It takes time in the morning for me to become George. Time to adjust to what is expected of George and how he is to behave. By the time I've dressed and put the final layer of polish on the now slightly stiff but quite perfect George, I know fully what part I'm supposed to play.
That part is not the part of a grieving widower, because that would be an admission that a friend who died in a car crash was more than a friend. Jim was, in fact, George's spouse. They'd lived together for 16 years.
Looking in the mirror, staring back at me, isn't so much a face as the expression of a predicament.
Just get through the goddamn day.
The film gives us that day. George, played with enormous subtlety by Colin Firth, is surrounded by people, but might as well be invisible, a gay man in a world that only acknowledges homosexuals to condemn them. So he leaves things unsaid with colleagues and speaks in a kind of code to his students, one they can't quite decipher, about prejudice and how it's used to bolster 60s fears.
The fear of being attacked. The fear that there are communists lurking around every corner. The fear that some little Caribbean country that doesn't believe in our way of life poses a threat to us. The fear that black culture may take over the world. The fear of Elvis Presley's hips.
Actually, maybe that one is a real fear.
Not a smile from the class. George remains invisible, except to one student, Kenny, who comes to him with questions, including one he's not quite asking. Christopher Isherwood's novel is the chronicle of a single day in George's life, and while Tom Ford's film also chronicles a single day, the director has made one adjustment. The film's George can find no reason to go on, so he's quietly decided not to. And that adds urgency as he cleans out his desk, appreciates the smell of a dog's fur, as if for the first time, and gets quietly plastered with his closest friend, played by Julianne Moore, who has loved him for 2 decades without ever understanding him.
Don't you ever miss this? What we could have been to each other. Having a real relationship and kids.
I had Jim.
No, I mean a real relationship. What you and Jim had together was wonderful, but wasn't it really just a substitute for something else?
So is that what you really think after all these years? Jim was not a substitute for anything. Do you understand?
And there is no substitute for Jim.
Director Tom Ford films all of this so elegantly, with a designer's eye, every shot precisely framed, that for a time it seems he might actually be making things too stylish. Sleek 60s clothing, a house out of Architectural Digest. The filming is so controlled it feels a little airless. But as the beige on gray visuals glow with warmer colors when emotions flare, you realize this director has made style strategic. George is a man who manages his feelings, and visualizing him in such pristine terms lets Ford highlight the tiniest of gestures, the finessing he does to navigate a can't-ask, can't-tell world, and the glimmers of hope that flare unexpectedly at the edges of despair. For a single man, despite all George's grief, is about someone who's finally learning to live in the moment, a moment that Ford makes at once wrenching and ravishing. I'm Bob Mandela.
This is Science Friday from NPR News. I'm Ira Flatow.
The accumulation of CO2 and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere can lead to hotter, longer heat waves that threaten the health of the sick, the poor, the elderly. They can increase ground-level ozone pollution linked to asthma and other respiratory illnesses.
That's Lisa Jackson, head of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency. Her announcement that greenhouse gases are a threat to public health came Monday, just as thousands of people from around the world were making their way to Copenhagen to talk climate change. And they've been at it now for almost a week. And joining us to fill us in on what's happening there is Elliot Dieringer. He is Vice President for International Strategies at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Arlington, Virginia. He's talking with us today from Copenhagen. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Good to be with you.
Nice to have you back. Is it possible to summarize for us what the main issues are and what is being talked about at this point?
Well, the issues are how you assemble countries in a meaningful framework that commits them to action. And at this moment, I think, Ira, I'd say that we're likely to get both more and less than we at the Pew Center had hoped for out of this conference.
Hmm.
On the one hand, every major emitting country is coming to Copenhagen with an explicit pledge to curb its emissions. The U.S. has put a provisional target on the table. China and India have put numbers on the table. And I wouldn't have predicted just a few weeks ago that we would have all that. But at the same time, these are, at this stage, political commitments. What we need to do is convert them into legally binding commitments. And what we really hope to see here is some solid progress toward building the legal architecture that will accomplish that over the coming year. And at the moment, it's a little hard to say just how far we'll get on that piece.
So you're saying we may not have a treaty that comes out of this meeting?
Oh, I think there's a very, very little likelihood of actually having a treaty agreed here in Copenhagen. A few weeks ago, President Obama and a number of other leaders quite explicitly lowered expectations, saying we're not going to get that far. What we're aiming for here is a political agreement, an interim political agreement that hopefully moves us much closer to a treaty.
Mm-hmm. There's been an argument going on that says you know, the underdeveloped world can't pay for some of the kinds of things that the developed countries can. Has there been any movement on helping to fund those underdeveloped countries and pick up some of the load for them?
Part of the deal here will be some money in the near term, between now and 2012. The number that's been floated is on the order of $10 billion a year. President Obama has talked about ramping up to $10 billion in 2012. So I'm pretty confident that if we have a deal, it will include money on that scale in that time frame. But I think that we're going to have to continue negotiating toward a longer-term arrangement to provide the much greater flows that are needed to help developing countries both get their acts together in terms of reducing their emissions, but also especially for the most poor and vulnerable countries, helping them adapt to the impacts of climate change.
We played a clip of Lisa Jackson, the new administrator for the EPA, and she issued a statement on Monday saying that carbon dioxide is a threat to public health. Is that factoring into the discussion over there at all?
The fact of the endangerment finding by the U.S., I mean, I think people have taken note of it. Those of us who are Americans are pleased to be able to say that our government has now officially recognized that fact. And I think for the Obama administration, it's another piece of evidence that they are doing their best to move forward on the issue. Mm-hmm. But materially, I don't think it's really changing the dynamic here, because everyone understands that for the U.S. to really be in a position to commit itself, we need some legislation through Congress. Mm-hmm. And hopefully we'll see that next year.
Mm-hmm. Give us an idea of what the flavor of the meeting was like. I was at the first one back in 1974. At the first UN conference in Stockholm, and it was part, you know, trade fair, part demonstrators, part working, part all kinds of pieces in there.
Yeah,
it was like a be-in or a happening, as we said back in the 70s.
It's all of that and more, and I mean, maybe the best way to describe it is semi-controlled chaos. I mean, there is in fact a negotiation taking place here. The negotiation itself is very disaggregated. I mean, you have multiple issues being negotiated simultaneously in different rooms, some of them open to observers, some of them not open, some of them with all parties represented, some of them with a few, and a constant round of bilateral meetings between governments. But most of the people here aren't negotiators, and a lot of them are working to get their message out, back-to-back press conferences, all sorts of presentations. I mean, it's part academic conference, spontaneous little protests breaking out, all manner of proselytizing, and lots of people just milling around in the hallways trying to find out what's going on, because this negotiation is so disaggregated. The reality is that at any given moment, no one has the complete picture of where things stand. So you have to pump people for information as best you can.
Is that going to gel a little bit before the end of the meeting?
It has to. I mean, Generally, things come together at the end. In this case, we have more than 100 heads of state coming, so there's real pressure on these negotiators to get a deal together. These heads of state don't want to arrive and find out they don't have a deal to bless. So I'm confident we'll have an agreement. I'm not yet confident how strong an agreement it will be and whether it's going to create that clear path toward the final legal agreement we need.
Right. Is President Obama slated to show up?
Yes, every expectation at this point is that he'll be there here on the final day of the conference next Friday.
So he's going home first and then coming back.
Yes, that's my understanding.
Would have been just a hop, skip, and a jump right over from Scanton.
Well, his original plan was to come here on his way to Oslo, but
right.
that plan changed. I mean, I think there was some pressure from other governments, heads of state. They wanted him here at the end. I think symbolically that counts for a lot with a lot of people. It will be a pretty momentous occasion.
All right, Elliot, thank you for taking time, staying up to join us today.
Happy to be with you, and happy Hanukkah, Ira.
Thank you. You too. Elliot Derringer is Vice President for International Strategies at the Pew Center on Global Climate Change in Arlington, Virginia.
Now, some thoughts on poetry and the quest to be profound. Andrei Crădescu hasn't always been a commentator for this program. He once had another line of literary work.
I once had a job writing fortune cookies for an adult fortune cookie factory in San Francisco for $5 a fortune. And I got to say things like, "You owe me $100," or "Read this twice, you still won't understand it." I quit and stuck to poetry, which pays nothing but keeps its dignity. I could now say things like, "The happy man needs no prose." The last fortune cookie I got said, "You will know the truth in time," which I always suspected, and the truth is that time will make truth irrelevant, because by the time you find it, you won't have any feelings about it. About truth, I mean. Time is truth, and there is no truth in time, as John Keats never said, but timekeeper is the best job you can have. This is my job. I'm a watch with feelings. The truth is also that the fortune cookies I didn't write had as much truth in them as the ones I did write. You just had to think about them more. When I first started writing, every poet wanted to be profound. Then every poet tried hard not to be profound, and that was a lot harder. Now, in the future, profound is everywhere. In every fortune cookie and commercial, so there is considerably less pressure on poets. Except to make money, of course, but to make money, you must use prose. It's like they say about the president: running is poetry, governing is prose. Me, I just run. I'm so poetic, I date all my letters 2010 already, and sometimes even 2011 and 2012. I just don't email them. So, in time, you'll find the stash of my letters, dated in the future, that will be well past by the time you find them, and they will say things like, "I told you so," or, if you say that again, it will be a quote, "Happy New Year."
Andrei Crădescu is editor of Exquisite Corpse, a literary journal. You can find it at corpse.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris. On Monday, NASA plans to launch a new space telescope. It will scan the sky to discover hidden asteroids and stars. As NPR's Nell Greenfield Boyce reports, the telescope may be able to find objects that are close to Earth but have been too dim to see.
Right now, you are shining with infrared light. So is anything warmer than absolute zero: an ice cube, your desk, plus faraway asteroids and stars. This new telescope is designed to detect hard-to-see space objects by looking for their infrared glow. The telescope is called the Wide Field Infrared Survey Explorer, or WISE. To make sure WISE isn't blinded by its own heat, it has to be kept super cold, minus 438 degrees Fahrenheit. Bill Iris is the project manager at NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab in California. He says the telescope will be insulated by a giant high-tech thermos bottle called a cryostat that's cooled with frozen hydrogen.
We have now 40 pounds of solid hydrogen in our cryostat. Some people think it looks like R2-D2 without wheels. It's kind of a funny-looking thing.
The funny-looking thing is about the size of a polar bear. A rocket will blast it into orbit around the Earth. WISE will then spend about 6 months taking more than 1 million images that will be stitched together to create a panoramic infrared view of the entire sky. Amy Meinzer is deputy project scientist for WISE. She says WISE should find many previously unseen asteroids, including ones that might be threatening to smack into Earth. To explain how WISE will do this, she held up two rocks at a press conference.
One of these rocks is sort of a light and shiny color, and the other one is a much darker color, sort of like a piece of coal.
Meinzer says if these were space rocks, asteroids, a telescope that looks for visible light would detect sunlight reflecting off the small, brightly colored rock. The big, dark rock would be too faint to see.
But in infrared light, both of these objects look equally bright, and in fact, this dark asteroid over here may stand out more to an infrared telescope, because what you're seeing is the heat that's being radiated from the asteroid.
Besides dark asteroids, the telescope is also expected to pick up dim stars. A kind of failed star called a brown dwarf doesn't burn as hot as our sun. Instead, it has a relatively feeble glow. So even though astronomers expect lots of brown dwarfs to be in the neighborhood around our sun, they've only detected a handful. Peter Eisenhart is the project scientist for WISE. He says this telescope should detect many nearby brown dwarfs.
And it's possible that one of these nearby brown dwarfs is even closer to the sun than any star that we now know of. The closest star that we know of now is called Proxima Centauri. It's about 4 light years away.
And he notes that brown dwarfs may have planets around them. So if WISE discovers that our closest star neighbor is actually a brown dwarf, it may be that there are planets beyond our solar system that are closer than we ever thought. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.